19.2 meter band.
Today is Thursday, September the 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. America's top military officer describes the Afghanistan evacuation as a logistical success, but a strategic failure.
I recommended that we maintain 2,500 troops in Afghanistan. And I also recommended earlier in the fall of 2020 that we maintain 4,500 at that time. Those are my personal views.
And the select committee investigating the January 6th insurrection issues a second round of subpoenas to individuals who were affiliated with the organization Women for America First. And French President Emmanuel Macron says that Europe must assert independence from the U.S. following France's outrage of a submarine deal between the U.S. and Australia.
This is one of these, if you like, the quid pro quo that Emmanuel Macron has been making, saying, okay, you want to talk to us, you want us to be your friends again, you've got to help us out.
And a Yemeni humanitarian organization is this year's winner of the UN Refugee Agency's prestigious Nansen Refugee Award. We have those stories and more coming up right here on International Edition. Stay tuned. And for our top story, U.S. lawmakers are expected to vote again on a bill to keep the government funded past the end of the month and avoid a shutdown. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
Faced with Republican opposition to linking the routine government funding with the debt limit vote, Democrats are separating the two, stripping out the more heated debate over the debt limit for another day, closer to a separate October deadline. The Treasury Secretary is urging Congress to protect the full faith and credit of the U.S. by acting as soon as possible to either raise the debt limit or suspend it.
U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, in joint Senate testimony with Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell, told lawmakers that failing to lift the nation's borrowing limit could be a disastrous event that would trigger a financial crisis and calamity. Conway Gittens of Reuters reports.
We're in the midst of a fragile but rapid recovery from the pandemic-induced recession.
Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen and Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell were back on Capitol Hill Tuesday. America's two top financial and economic leaders were supposed to be there to update the Senate Banking Committee on the economic rebound and the federal spending, known as the CARES Act, which fueled it. But the hearing quickly turned to the looming deadline for Congress to raise the nation's borrowing limit and what would happen if it doesn't.
America would default for the first time in history. The full faith and credit of the United States would be impaired, and our country would likely face a financial crisis and economic recession as a result. We must address this issue to honor commitments made by this and prior Congresses, including those made to address the health and economic impact of the pandemic. It's necessary to avert a catastrophic event for our economy.
Yellen repeatedly tried to make clear that raising the debt limit was needed to pay the bills that were already accrued and warned the Treasury will run out of ways to do so on October 18th. Republicans on the committee said by raising the debt limit now, it would only encourage Democrats to spend more and have vowed to vote against raising the debt limit, breaking with longstanding bipartisan tradition.
This would be a manufactured crisis we had imposed on this country, which has been going through a very difficult period, is on the road to recovery, and it would be a self-inflicted wound of enormous proportions.
Powell stayed out of the discussion on the debt limit, but did remark on what he thought the services sector and the economy at large needed to keep the rebound going.
In my view, the most important thing is to get control of the pandemic. That's what's keeping people out of sporting arenas and off of airplanes and out of restaurants and bars. And we saw that very clearly in the August payroll report, where job creation in these industries had gone from very strong for several months to zero in August. So it's really all about, at this point, getting the Delta variant and really, frankly, getting vaccination and immunity up higher.
Both will be back on Thursday to testify before the House Financial Services Committee.
White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki says that she's confident there will be a vote today But she warned that this was a precarious time in the talks.
I think it's pretty clear we're in the middle of a negotiation and that everybody's going to have to give a little. This is why we all came to Washington. It's like an episode of a TV show. I'm not in a position to look in a crystal ball here.
Which TV show?
Maybe The West Wing, if something good happens, maybe Veep, if not. I'm not sure. I will assess tomorrow where we stand.
Meanwhile, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi told reporters that she has no patience for lawmakers who she suggests are playing politics by refusing to approve legislation to raise the debt limit. A judge won't block a Nebraska university's vaccine mandate. AP's Walter Ratliff reports.
A judge refused to block Creighton University's requirement that all students get vaccinated against COVID-19, despite the objections of a handful of students who said getting the shots would violate their religious beliefs against abortion. In August, the Catholic University in Omaha, Nebraska mandated that all students get vaccinated. The lawsuit says the students object because vaccines were developed or tested using cells from aborted fetuses. The Vatican has declared that such vaccines are morally acceptable when others aren't available. The university says it believes the students have a moral responsibility to get the coronavirus vaccine to protect the community. I'm Walter Ratliff.
America's top military officer has described the Afghanistan evacuation as a logistical success, but a strategic failure. General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, spoke at a contentious Senate hearing on the U.S. military's withdrawal and evacuation from Afghanistan. VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb has the details.
The top U.S. general Tuesday bluntly assessing the Afghanistan evacuation mission.
It was a logistical success, but a strategic failure.
And the overall end of the war.
Outcomes in a war like this, an outcome that is a strategic failure, the enemy is in charge in Kabul. There's no way else to describe that. That outcome is a cumulative effect of 20 years, not 20 days.
Milley, along with Central Command Chief General Frank McKenzie, said they personally had wanted a minimum of 2,500 troops to remain.
My assessment was back in the fall of 20, and it remained consistent throughout, that we should keep a steady state of 2,500, and it could bounce up to 3,500, maybe something like that, in order to move toward a negotiated, gated solution.
I recommended that we maintain 2,500 troops in Afghanistan. And I also recommended earlier in the fall of 2020 that we maintain 4,500 at that time. Those are my personal views. I also have a view that the withdrawal of those forces would lead inevitably to the collapse of the Afghan military forces and eventually the Afghan government.
The general's assertions contrasted with those of President Joe Biden, who has said he did not recall any of his advisors urging him to keep a small U.S. military force in Afghanistan. The White House Tuesday again defending the decision to remove all troops.
And if we had kept 2,500 troops there, we would have increased the number of troops, we would have been at war with the Taliban, we would have had more U.S. casualties. That was a reality everybody was clear-eyed about.
Both Republicans and Democrats slammed the administration for leaving Americans and Afghan allies behind after the president said he would not do so. They also asked pointed questions on the future of the counter-terror war there.
Has the military's task to defeat terror threats from Afghanistan gotten harder?
Yes.
Does the Taliban and its other terror partners have more ability to train and prepare in Afghanistan now that we've left?
More ability, yes.
Are you confident that we can deny organizations like Al-Qaeda and ISIS the ability to use Afghanistan as a launch pad for terrorist activity?
I think that's yet to be seen.
The military has come under harsh criticism for its errant drone strike in the final days of the withdrawal that killed 10 civilians, a strike for which McKenzie has taken responsibility. The top defense officials also reiterated that U.S. intelligence had failed to anticipate the rapid fall of Kabul. But in their lessons learned, they had a message for America's civilian leaders.
So I would advise any leader, don't put date certains on end dates. Make things conditions-based. In two presidents in a row put dates on it.
An ousted Afghan leader, Ashraf Ghani.
And when your president leaves suddenly in the middle of a campaign for the capital, I think that finishes any chance at all you might have had of making a stand there.
Carla Babb, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. French President Emmanuel Macron says that Europe must assert independence from the U.S. following France's anger over a submarine deal between the U.S. and Australia. Last week, French authorities voiced outrage after the U.S. struck a deal with Australia that will allow for sharing of defense capabilities, including nuclear-powered submarines. The new Indo-Pacific alliance, known as AUKUS, disrupted a major deal between France and Australia. The U.S. and France have been engaged in trying to mend relations, including a phone call between Biden and Macron and meetings on the sidelines of the U.N. General Assembly. Catherine Field is a reporter and analyst based in Paris. I reached her by phone and I asked her if the remarks by the French leader were precipitated by the fallout between the two allies.
Up to a point it is, yes. Emmanuel Macron has been saying for some time that Europe has to stand on its own two feet. You may remember a couple of years ago, he said that he thought that NATO was brain dead. That was his exact words. He got a lot of pushback from that within the EU and within NATO countries who are a little bit reticent of having a security arrangement which isn't so dependent on the Americans. And I'm specifically talking about the Baltic states. They really feel as though they've got to have America at the center of their security arrangement. So they're a little concerned about that. This disagreement with the United States, United Kingdom, and Australia over the submarines, over the AUKUS alliance, has really brought it back to the fore. And I think Emmanuel Macron is using that as an excuse to go back, revisit this topic and say, look, we cannot rely on the Americans, but we do have the capability, if we all get together, to be strong just within Europe.
Right. Now, it was reported that Macron and President Biden had a conversation after that fallout. And at the UN General Assembly, there was a lot of diplomatic activity between the two countries. How serious is this spat between the two countries? And what is France hoping to get out of any possible reconciliation talks, if you may? You know, French Foreign Minister Le Drian told Secretary of State Antony Blinken that, you know, time and actions were needed to restore the trust. Well, what kind of action could he be referring to, especially as regards to the Sahel?
First off, I have never heard the sort of allegations against an ally that France has been leveling at the United States and Australia before. These are allegations where they've accused the others of being liars, of being traitors, of a stab in the back. These are not the sort of words you usually hear being described for another ally. So the damage done by what they consider to be a backdoor deal in the Indo-Pacific is enormous. There are many aspects to it, but the main one is that there is a feeling in Paris that America, particularly the State Department and the White House, does not understand Europe. You rightly mentioned the Sahel. This is an area where the French have been very concerned that the Americans are going to pull out of the area. Now, yes, the French are indeed scaling back their own military operations in the Sahel, but they are desperate to have the Americans stay there because they need the Americans for intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, air refueling. They need them for their listening stations. So this is one of these, if you like, the quid pro quo that Emmanuel Macron has been making. Say, okay, you want to talk to us? You want us to be your friends again? You've got to help us out in the Sahel. And in particular, we need you to make sure that those drone bases in Niger, there are two in particular, that the French want the Americans to keep those open. They need them. They are desperate for all these operations which they're doing in the Sahel, and particularly you're in Mali, where there is this realization in France now that they're not going to win. All they can do is stop the insurgency from heading down towards our strategic areas, such as the Côte d'Ivoire.
That was Catherine Field. I reached her in the French capital, Paris.
Voice of America.
A Yemeni humanitarian organization is this year's winner of the UN Refugee Agency's prestigious Nansen Refugee Award. The Jill Albena Association for Humanitarian Development has provided life-saving assistance over the past 5 years to tens of thousands of Yemeni civilians forcibly displaced by conflict. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
In announcing the award, UN High Commissioner for Refugees Filippo Grandi praised the courageous work of the organization's staff and volunteers for providing a lifeline to thousands of Yemen's most destitute people amid a raging conflict. He said he hoped the award would put the spotlight on this country's catastrophic situation, which has been all but forgotten by the international community. The United Nations calls Yemen one of the world's worst humanitarian crises. It reports nearly 4 million people have fled their homes in search of safety. More than 5 million people are on the brink of famine. And 80% of the country's population of 29 million needs humanitarian aid. Amin Jubran, who founded Jil Albena in 2017, has himself been displaced by fighting and nearly killed. He says the dangers and obstacles he and his family have experienced have inspired him to devote his life to helping others in need. He speaks through an interpreter from the Yemeni capital, Sana'a.
We in Jil Albena provide shelters for displaced people who have lost their homes. Materials that we use are locally grown, and they are also woven by displaced individuals and members of the host community as well. They provide skills and sources of income to those who work on these shelter kits. We also try to support the local market.
Jil Albena is based in the Red Sea port city of Hodeidah. It has provided jobs and around 18,000 emergency shelters for an internally displaced people in the provinces of Hodeidah and Haja. The Nansen Award comes with a cash prize of $150,000 donated by the Swiss and Norwegian governments. Jubran says he will use the money to implement projects to support members of the community and the displaced. He says one project will focus on skills training for women so they can generate income and become self-reliant. A second project, he says, aims to train and provide fishermen with essential items so they can restore their livelihood opportunities. And lastly, he says Jil Albena will give young people technical training they need to get jobs, earn a living, and look forward to a viable future. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And in other news, the Select Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection has issued its second round of subpoenas to individuals who were affiliated with the organization Women for America First. The individuals were involved in the planning and organization of the Stop the Steal rally that served as a prelude to the deadly riot at the U.S. Capitol building. And the U.S. State Department says that it is working to verify the accuracy of the list of passengers aboard a charter plane carrying more than 100 U.S. citizens and lawful permanent residents evacuated from Afghanistan on Wednesday after the flight's organizers said that Washington had denied it landing rights. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Jackson Bunganyi. Scientists in the European Union's Copernicus Atmosphere Monitoring Service is keeping an eye on the ozone hole over the Antarctic and are finding that it's now bigger than the continent itself. Rick Pantaleo joins us with this episode of Science in a Minute.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists with the European Union's Copernicus Atmosphere Monitoring Service is keeping an eye on the ozone hole over the Antarctic and is finding that it is now bigger than the continent itself. According to their press release, the hole, which is a thinning of the layer, has recently grown significantly and is larger than 75% of ozone holes at the same point in the season since 1979. The ozone layer is part of the atmosphere that protects Earth from the sun's harmful ultraviolet rays. According to the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the growth of the hole is due to atmospheric and chemical conditions specific to that area that bolsters the effectiveness of ozone-depleting gases. The UN recently marked the anniversary of the 1987 Montreal Protocol, which regulates the manufacture and use of chemicals that were found to reduce ozone. I am VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. Tight global energy supplies pushed oil prices above $80 a barrel for the first time in 3 years on Tuesday before retreating in a broader sell-off in financial markets. Demand rose due to easing lockdown measures and wider rollouts of COVID-19 vaccinations. analysts say, as well as disruptions in supply due to hurricanes in the United States. So, will OPEC increase supplies? For VOA, Del Gavlak reports from Amman in Jordan.
Goldman Sachs expects oil prices for benchmark Brent crude to hit $90 per barrel by the end of the year as supply tightens. The recovery from the impact of the Delta variant of the coronavirus was faster than expected, especially with international travel, it said, while Hurricane Ida hit U.S. production. Although some analysts find that the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries and their allies known as OPEC Plus have been slow to raise their oil output to address the shortfalls, others like Carol Nehla, CEO of Crystal Energy in London, told VOA that there is no real oil supply shortage.
I struggle to see how we can have a shortage of supply when you have OPEC Plus sitting on several millions of barrels a day of spare capacity. So usually, if you look historically, when we had serious crises in oil markets and prices going significantly high, that spare capacity was very low. Today, that is not the case. So we have voluntary decision not to put all that oil in the market, and that's contributing to the current tightness. Saudi Arabia, UAE, and Kuwait don't seem to be facing any problem. If they want, they can easily appease the pressure in the market.
Neil Quilliam, an associate fellow at London's Chatham House, told VOA that it is hard to say whether OPEC, which meets next week, will increase production. But he notes that U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan met Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman earlier this week.
But I would find it really hard to imagine that, you know, given where the price of oil is at the moment and given the OPEC meeting next week, that that didn't form an important part of that conversation. I mean, it's hard to say, but the signals so far are they're going to stick firm to where production currently is, and they're going to keep in alignment with plans to increase production by 400,000 barrels each month until the end of the year.
Norbert Ricker of the Swiss private bank Julius Baer said that the deficit in world gas supplies is driving the global energy crunch. He told the Wall Street Journal that this is now spilling over into the oil market because of the expectation that this energy scarcity means we're going to use oil for spillover demand. Oil can be used in some power plants to generate electricity when gas prices surge. Nehle says gas markets have no such OPEC Plus entity. Currently, Russia is seen to be restricting some of its supplies to Europe to gain more support for its Nord Stream 2 pipeline and to take advantage of higher prices. But Russia does not have the same impact on gas prices as you have, for example, with OPEC 2 in oil markets, she says. Gas prices have risen in part due to a worldwide production deficit, depleted inventories, as well as China turning to gas from coal. Analysts say the energy crisis will worsen if there is a very cold winter ahead in the northern hemisphere. Dale Gavlek for VOA News, Amman.
A number of new technologies are popping up that could help bring global energy-related carbon dioxide emissions to net zero by 2050, and all need investment. Governments worldwide are having to decide which one suits their geography and how much they can spend on a given technology. More with VOA's Mariama Diallo.
In September, some energy companies that have been trying to rid the atmosphere of carbon celebrated some big milestones. In Iceland, two companies launched one of the largest direct air carbon capture and storage plants. Speaking with Reuters, Jan Worsbacher, Climeworks CEO and co-founder.
With a capacity of 4,000 tons of CO2 that are captured from the air every year. So that's the nominal capacity. And we are then handing over this CO2 to our partners from Carbfix, who inject it underground. And the CO2 there is mineralized with the basalt rock. So and it's turned into stone, literally.
Fusion, like direct air carbon capture, is another potential new development in alternative energy. Fusion is a carbon-free energy source based on the same principles that power the Earth's sun. In France, a giant fusion experiment involving the largest magnet so far arrived at the International Thermonuclear Experimental Reactor, or ITER, an international nuclear fusion research and engineering mega project. A big step, ITER says, toward its goal of producing electricity without a radioactive byproduct. Laban Koblenz, spokesperson for ITER, says it's all about priorities.
ITER is expected to cost
20 billion euros, give or take, for construction. Right now, Europe is importing 1 billion euros of petroleum every day. So they're paying for each year basically every 3 weeks.
Earlier this year, the International Energy Agency warned that climate pledges by governments to date could fall short of what is required to bring global energy-related CO2 emissions to net zero by 2050. Cambridge University's Laura Diaz-Anadon.
And if we don't have a clean electricity, then, you know, that's not going to reduce emissions. So the first focus should be decarbonizing the power sector. And this means that renewables and storage and some technologies that can provide firm capacity of power are going to be really important.
AJ Gambier, a senior research fellow at the Grantham Institute for Climate Change at Imperial College London, says he believes that so far, two energy sources have made considerable leaps.
Solar photovoltaics, wind turbines, those are penetrating into energy systems quite fast around the world at the moment. They're falling in cost extremely rapidly, so they're proving very promising in terms of low carbon options.
But challenges remain when it comes to storing energy in the long term.
So, for example, we've made a huge amount of progress in terms of the cost and performance of lithium-ion batteries. Over the past 10 years, the cost of lithium-ion batteries has gone down by around 80-85%, mainly because of the applications in the electric vehicle market.
You know, you can't have batteries at the moment that are economic enough or big enough to store all of the electricity needs that a country will require over the winter months, for example. And there we look to things like long duration energy storage. We already have that in terms of pumped hydropower, but then we have a raft of other technologies which are either existent or being developed. We have this big role for potentially hydrogen as a store of energy.
The 2021 United Nations Climate Change Conference, or COP26, will take place in November in Glasgow, Scotland. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
The International Rescue Committee says that more than 2 million Kenyans are facing hunger due to poor rainfall. Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta declared a national disaster this month because of drought. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
36-year-old Suleiman Ahmed Osman lost 50% of his livestock to drought in the past 6 months. He says more are dying now due to worsening drought.
When we lost, you know, this number of animals, and there's no any other source of income, there's no other source of where we can source our daily meals, because we normally used to get milk and meat, and sometimes selling the animals to get other source of food like the rice or sugar and other things. Now that the animals are very emaciated, nobody can buy them. No milk, because the drought has affected them to an extent that no milk can come from the animal.
The International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies, IFRC, says Kenya received insufficient rainfall during the October to December 2020 and March to May 2021 rainy seasons, leading to the current drought situation. The IFRC report said that the arid and semi-arid areas received less than 50% of the average rainfall in June. The three counties in northeastern Kenya received less than 25% of average rainfall. Abdullahi Musa has been buying animal feeds and water for 4 months now for his more than 100 cattle in Garissa along the Kenyan-Somalia border. There are two sets of livestock herders, he says. There are those who the drought in Kenya has affected them. There are those who crossed to Somalia to get pasture but came back due to lack of water, he says. I'm among the people who are not so affected. I have lost some animals, but most of them are alive. But 90% of animal herders have lost their livestock. They got nothing. The International Rescue Committee says 2.1 million people in Kenya are now food insecure. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great week ahead.